Hello, welcome to the Game Narrative Kaleidoscope podcast. I'm Sagar Baroshi.
And I'm John Ingold.
And this podcast is all about the craft of game narrative and the craft of game writing. We have here today Pete Stewart. Pete, welcome.
Hi, thank you for having me.
Sweet. We would love to hear a little bit about you, about who you are, what brought you to this world that we're all in, and then later we can dive into your article.
Sure, yeah. So as you said, my name is Pete Stewart, just doubling down on that. And I've been a writer in games for 12, 13 years. It's about 2012 when I joined the game industry. I joined Creative Assembly as a tester, making the Total War games. First game I released was Total War Rome 2, which, you know, maybe not the best game to be a tester on, but then after that I moved from there into the writing team and stayed on Total War, writing like Attila, Warhammer 1 and 2, and most notably I think Three Kingdoms, before moving in 2020 to Respawn, where I helped ship 2023's Jedi Survivor, Time is a Flat Circle, and now working on Secret Things, so I can't talk about those, but yeah, so just a bit of a span of Bit of a varied span from the beginning to where we are now.
Awesome. So your article is called "The Bricks and the Gaps." Would you like to just sort of outline what was the thesis? What did you want to say?
One of the situations where I thought of a really cool title and then had to try and work backwards to make the entry of the wouldn't fit. I don't really mention it until the end, but essentially the thesis is that too much world building is not necessarily advantageous, right? And world building should follow, as I see it, like a reinforcement of what you're trying to tell in the story, but also leaving space for interpretation for the player. Like, obviously the article goes on into more detail than that, but at its core, that there's nothing necessarily wrong about over-explaining a world if it's still in service of your themes and stuff. But I think if you break every gap, then you're just building a wall that a player can look at and not letting them see what is through the gaps or find what their own interpretations of things and build their own little worlds within your game.
I love this defense of ambiguity, basically, that you have, right? That is very often it's the things that you don't say or that you might be inclined to say, but if you leave them a bit open, things are exciting. But of course, you can't just leave absolutely everything open. You sort of have to tease people with just enough to feed into. For an average project, because you've worked on such a wide variety of them, Pete, like how should a games writer who's, say, being hired onto a new team or initiating a new project, how should we think about sort of which bits to fill in and then which bits to leave open?
The ones that I think that, I mean, there are, I think there are numerous approaches, and one thing I'm really interested in is seeing people who disagree with the article. I'm as interested in that as I am people who agree with it. Is where I think do you find the most interesting spots for reinforcement of your own narrative? I think that's the first thing you should do. And I think I say in the article as well, is establishing what needs to be known is also your first port of call. And often you'll find that happens probably in your critical path, in your, like, as part of your core story experience, like, oh, you need to know that this planet used to be a prison, or you need to know that this place used to be prosperous and now isn't, for instance. Those things tend to come across quite organically. I think how does that reinforce your theme? So, like, oh, this is a ghost town and you're coming here as a loner. I'm describing westerns. I don't know why I'm describing westerns, but it's a bit of a broad question. But I'm thinking about it through the lens of the stuff that I do or have done at Respawn, mostly in that once you've got your core stuff down, you relegate, for a slightly less charitable word, more side information, more side world building to side systems. So, like, oh, your encyclopedias and your random curios that you find in the world, those are, I don't want to say less important, but they're clearly not defined by the critical path that you have to follow. You don't need to find them. That's for the curious player.
So it's kind of like a structural approach to world building. Where the information is in the world is almost a clue to the player as to how I don't even know what the right word for it is. It's not quite how significant it is it? It's how much the game cares that you know it or something like that. Is that right?
Yeah, but only cares in so much as your core understanding of the experience, right?
Like right, so that you can engage, really.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
It's like, there used to be a mine, at the bottom of the mine there is a gem, like, and the gem is important to your story. You don't need to know about anything but the mine, essentially, right? You maybe need to know why the mine was abandoned, et cetera, but you don't need to know, the fueling depot that helps the things get to the, like, the trucks get to the mine every day. That's fun and interesting, but it's not a core experience. I think I use, it feels like every time I meet you, John, I espouse about 80 days, but I'm going to do it again. like some kind of...
There's a very welcome on this podcast.
Yeah,
yes.
Yeah. I think a lot about when you first go to Paris, right? Which is obviously very early in the game. And Passepartout 2 is like, I'm going to go for a walk. You have a choice to go for a walk through along the Seine. And you're looking at they're putting out the gas lights and their robots, like the mechanized robots. You don't really... And there's a little hint like, oh, before the war and back in this. And so you sort of establish in this very... short, quite elegant section. Oh, so we're sort of in a steampunky situation. There are robots. There is a war. And you can delve into that at other points, but then you sort of move on. Like, he wants to go into the circus, or he wants to go into the bar or something, and then that's it. And I feel like that's... I don't need any more than that to understand the setting of the place that I'm in right now. Even though, and part of me is like, oh, I would love to know more about that, but it's not vital.
So, would you say that as a writer, you're naturally drawn towards kind of the shortest version of the thing that you could do? Because, like, you can imagine the maximalist version of 80 Days, right? Where, when you first hit a robot, then it suddenly goes, here is the history of robots in 20 years.
Here's a whole side game you could do of just manufacturing robots.
And, like, some people would go absolutely apeshit for that version of the game and just really want... And then other, myself included, I'm very much more of the kind of... You just drop the word robot, and then I always think of the writer as a bit like a sort of cheeky character who drops the word robot and then runs away. Anyone can ask any questions.
Yeah.
So, like, on that spectrum, where do you find yourself landing?
I think that's interesting because it's like an instinct that I had to fight. I actually gave I spoke to some students in Bradford a couple of weeks ago at the Yorkshire Games Festival. I gave a talk, in fact, about game writing, and one of the things I was talking about was how brevity was one of the crucial, like, parts of it. Like, be brief, especially in a game, because you don't have that much real estate, or it varies the real estate, so it's best to assume that you don't have a lot. And that's an instinct that I've had to learn. I think when you become a writer, maybe for the very first time, maybe 10, 20, how many years ago, you want to tell the Silmarillion, you want to tell your Ulysses, right? And you want to write and write and write, and then your first lead, if they are any good, will tell you not to do that. And I think the same is true, like you're saying, like, clearly I think your instinct... There is a version of 80 Days, the maximalist version, that I would also love to play, but I don't think I want to play any more than the version that exists. Because what you've done, and what I hope to do in world building that I do, is, like you say, and to bring it back to the article, you say, oh, there's robots. What does that mean? And then the player's imagination hopefully goes off and it's like, oh, there was a conflict. What do these robots do? Where do they come from? You don't need to explain that. I mean, it's interesting working in an IP that, you know, is very highly explained and is very interesting to a lot of people, that is super explained. But you work within a small section of it, and within that section you don't have to tell them everything. Yeah. Especially when you have a massive backing, like, you don't have to do it. It's already there. In a lot of ways, which is another interesting, that's quite separate part, I think.
But it's quite a common experience, actually, for writers, right? Like, it is relatively common that we are working on other existing IPs and sometimes quite well-known ones, especially in a phase where the industry has felt like it's retrenching in some ways, or it's finding it more secure to invest in known spaces. That's a really interesting point, Pete, because if you're working with Star Wars, you don't need to... You can assume things, right? You don't have to assume total ignorance on the player. In fact, it would be odd that they had purchased this game without knowing what a Jedi is,
yes,
right?
Yes, exactly.
Given that it's in the title, right? So maybe that allows you to do more than just the most efficient thing sometimes. Like, the thing is, of course, this is the thing that we always hear as we start out in our careers as writers, and we sort of find a way of progressing here, that you must be efficient. You must, like, only put in what's absolutely necessary. But it does strike me that there is a failure state of that, which is... Rather than learning the lesson of choosing where to be brief and choosing what to leave open, you just try to take the same amount of exposition you would have done in your first draft, and then all of your writing is filled with just that, right? So you're doing somehow fewer lines, but without actually making the difficult choice of cutting things back, which...
Yeah.
I don't know if you've ever experienced that or whether that's different on an existing IP in the way you might operate.
Yeah, I feel it's with a massive IP, and obviously in the past we worked with Warhammer as well, which is maybe the densest IP I think I've ever seen in my life.
Yeah,
is, you know, they sort of live on exposition, and in a way they make it really fun. Like their writing is very like what we would probably not nice
characterful
purple. Yeah, characterful is a nicer way of saying flowery purple. You know, it's like it's very lurid even, but like in a way that's really enjoyable. So I don't ever resent reading sort of stuff, but that's sort of the contract you sign when you go into either playing or working on Warhammer. It's like, oh, it's going to be arch, it's going to be high, it's going to be you know, a little over explained, a little you know, elaborate. Other IPs don't have that, and I feel something like Star Wars, not to harp on about it too much, but like it's so broad that you can bring to it whatever you want. So if you choose, which I hope we do as game writers, to come in and be like, oh, we want this to be sharp and be brief and not have to sort of lean back on the lore in a way that needs over explaining, you have that benefit too, because even the most sort of uninitiated into that universe understands what a lightsaber is, right? You don't need to do that work. Thankfully, otherwise I would have very long scripts.
Well, and of course, like, you don't walk into any of, even if it's a brand new IP, mm-hmm. you walk in with some expectations, right? Like, there will be something that's linked to it. Like, you talk about John's 80 Days, like, it is off of a well-known existing novel, a classic, right? If you take something brand new, you don't walk in with totally zero expectations, right? Like, you know, oh, I'm in a fantasy world, or I'm in a sort of gothic horror space, and that's part of the fun, of course, right? Like, you can subvert that. Oh, it's a gothic horror space, but it's set in a very unexpected place, and you have the Seance of Blake Manor, and you have a like sort of interesting approach to it, and so it's almost like you can play with the meta element of this because you're not walking, you don't walk blind. A player doesn't walk blind into these spaces.
You can walk blind into these spaces, but that's like a different type of game. That's like a puzzle game. You know, where the world building is the something like Blueprints, right? It's like you step in and like, Oberdin, right? It's like you don't know what's happened. And it's very, but that's just like specifically to learn.
That's what the game is about, actually.
Yeah, exactly.
Then, right?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Even like higher, like AAA stuff, like Bloodborne, stuff of my favorite games, is like, well, the world, you'll never know, maybe, perhaps. Like, there's podcasts and essays and like literal books, like about what it possibly could mean. And I'm sure they know what it meant, but they don't have to tell you. And that's the thing that excites me. Sorry, go on, John.
No, I just think that's a really interesting question to me, is like, when you're building specifically for this effect of getting the player to ask questions and to be curious and to theorize. Like, real talk, how important is it for you to know the answers? Like, how much do we know the answers and then refuse to tell players? And how much do we just sort of vibe a mystery and then just that looks like a mystery? Do we have to play fair? What do you think?
Do I have to play fair? No, I don't think so. I think it's clothes making the men, right? I think certain... Perhaps more mainstream, but not necessarily always mainstream games are a bit more. You have to explain something. You have to the player is a not entering the space expecting it to be the Saints of Blake Manor or Blueprints or Redin or Bloodborne. Right, they expect it to be explained to them, or at least to have some common understanding that they can share with other people. They expect the wall to some degree, whereas you go into any of those other games and. Depending, like, it varies, obviously mileage may vary, but some of them, which completely obliterates my article, sort of doesn't have a wall. You know, there's no wall at all, or there's like a foundation stones. I think that's fine. Like, asking the player to do the labor of putting the wall together and seeing if it looks like someone else's wall is the fun, right?
I think this question is so interesting. Go on. Yeah,
I was going to ask, so does that mean that this choice about how we world build is more about the flavor of the project and less about a sort of strategy for doing world building? It's kind of something we should be choosing on a project by project basis and kind of invite as part of our toolbox.
Yeah, I feel like I can only speak, like, in the article to what I've done, you know, and then theorize a thing that I haven't. So to me, I'm like, this is how I will build a world in the way that I approach game writing and game design now. If I was asked to write a game that is more in a FromSoft style or is more in a mystery style, I would come back to this and be like, probably still focus on stuff like, if I am building the world, how does the revelation of the world building still do the things that I said, like reinforce the themes? In fact, more so with stuff, especially like Obra Dinn and Blueprint, is like, well, where did all these people go? Like, and the thematic elements of how you unravel that are more important than anything else. And what's curious to me, and having never done it, I wouldn't know the actual answer, is one of the points I made here, the middle point, is does the world leave space for the player to fill in the gaps with their own imagination in a game that's more mystery-based, where you are unraveling it as part of the plot? Does that still matter? Like, or do you expect by the end that you will have a complete picture that the player cannot interpret in any other way?
I love this question because, to be honest, like, I enjoy both types of stories, I suppose, like whether they're in games or otherwise, like ones that feel like puzzle boxes that you're sort of unraveling, and like you get this sort of Agatha Christie joy of saying like, oh yeah, they do all fit together by the end. Like, I love that. I really do love that. And that clearly requires some sense of coherence to everything such that you get that moment of, if I look back at the events that happened, they kind of fall into place. But equally, like, sometimes it feels, interestingly, sometimes it feels like worlds that are designed from the start to be maybe not mainstream, but big and expansive and a place where multiple types of stories can happen, almost by necessity, have to be the other case, have to be the case where you very strongly communicate sort of what the central emotional vibe is, the core is of this world, and then the stories that come can vary and don't always need to like coordinate with one another. Like the sort of CCP games as EVE Online maybe feels a little bit this way. They really strongly communicate this is the flavor of what you can do, and they purposefully sort of are quite hands-off with what the storytelling is and how everything happens to fit together. For Helldivers 2, we were quite similar. Like, you know, we have a plot, a really specific one, but it is a little kooky on purpose, and that was part of the vibe, right? It was part of the satire of the title. So maybe you found that on... It's interesting because, like, for a Total War game where you're repeating mechanics but not plot and world, maybe you've had to see this on both sides of it, even within the same franchise, actually.
Yeah, Total War is a... an interesting one, because like you say, you're not writing plot, but you are building worlds more than anything else, but at the same time, there's also you're not hamstrung, but the more interesting, especially with historical titles, which I have more experience with than the Warhammer stuff, is like Three Kingdoms. It's like everyone
that's the most interesting one.
Yeah
because that's like you're doing it off of mythology and love the of the great works of the past, and you're like, well, then so what, right?
It's twofold, right? Because A, we know it probably in more detail than we know a lot of other parts of history, and B, there is a mythologized element to it. I was actually just having this conversation the other day about the difference between something like Shogun, which is set in Japan, and Three Kingdoms, where it's like the different ways that we interpret mythologies. Like, so obviously they do have religious and Shinto deities and spiritualism and that's not the word I'm looking for, superstition, sorry, in ancient Japan, like, you know, this demon does that and these demons do that. But in a very literal way, in Three Kingdoms, it's like, oh no, there are dragons, right? There are dragons, and you will actually see them, and they will do these things. And I mean, that's difficult to navigate. But the way that you sort of approach world building in a Total War title is you are providing a player the tools to go and explore on their own, because you're not telling them a story. I mean, right. You are sort of telling them a story through like occasional cinematics of like, oh, Dong Zhuo is dead, etc. Like, that's a big moment, but they're more like milestones than they are like plot twists. You sort of give the player the tools to experience, like, you give them the history and then facilitate that with systems like dilemmas or quest chains and stuff, but they more feed into what you know, right, and then let them run. I mean, there's a thing, an argument we always have on Total War is like, how accurate are they at their core? And ultimately, it's like the history is like the baseboard. The history is like the foundation. And then the minute the player makes a decision that isn't historical, which is any decision, essentially, unless they really go
it breaks
for
off.
It breaks. And then they're off in like a new timeline. And you have to facilitate that. Well, you have to let them do that.
You have this amazing quote in your article, which is, facts are base camp, context setters. Mm. And like, basically, that's it. They start here, and then where you climb to, where you go to, is that's the whole point of the medium, right? That you're
You can't really curtail. Point. I mean, you can. But I think like Napoleon a long time ago, before my time, did it. Total War did quite well, where you're following very specifically his campaigns, and you have the beginning and the end. Oh, this is his campaign in the Alps, and this is a campaign in Russia, and this is his campaign in Egypt. Like, you know the beginning and the end point, but everything in between. Like, Napoleon didn't do that, but who cares, right? That's the player's experience. And that is a more curtailed version, and I kind of liked it. As a writer and a storyteller, you kind of have that inclination to be a little bit more rigid, I think, in telling story. But it's not something you can facilitate for a strategy game like that consistently. It was a fun experiment and a fun thing to do, but ultimately the player wants to do the sandboxing in a sandbox game, right? And you have to find a way to give them... Although world building is always there in a very, very concrete way, in a very quite brute force way in Total War. Like, you have a massive encyclopedia that tells you what this building is and why... And so you're sort of being the role of historical researcher, which is fun. So the player has that as a reference point, but yeah, then you just let them go in a kind of weird way.
So I think I have a question that I think is interesting about it, that in the more narrative games, you know, if you're working on a Star Wars game or an Indiana Jones game or something, then your world building is, like you said earlier, it's kind of the bedrock of it is, what is it the player needs to understand the story? Like, you need to understand that the magic goblet gives you infinite life, because otherwise you can't understand what the heck's going on in the story. You don't necessarily need to understand why, so long as you've got that bit of fact. Whereas in something like a Total War game, I guess you don't really need to understand any of the world building, or perhaps a little bit of functional stuff to sort of know who you're fighting, or I don't know what's more powerful than what, or whether a dragon is a good thing or a bad thing. But like, so when we're building that kind of world building, how do you know if you're doing it well? If you're not, it doesn't have this acid test of the player gets it, the player doesn't get it. So what, when it's feeling good, what does that feel like? How do we as writers, so, oh yeah, this is a really great bit, or this is a dog leg that's going nowhere and people are not going to care and I need to cut it. How do you make that call when you don't have this, oh fuck, wow, no one knows what a lightsaber is question?
If you're at the, if that's the opening, like, we'll come back to the Total War of it, but if the opening gambit is like you go in and someone doesn't know what a lightsaber is, then I think there's a band of elastic, which is the amount that we should tell the player, or like that we expect, and if it snaps back, it's on a basic fundamental question. It's like, oh, they don't know what a lightsaber is, or they get what it is, right? Or they understand that this giant light blade does the hurt, right? I don't know if I've ever, it's a really interesting hypothetical, because I don't think I've ever encountered someone that doesn't know what a lightsaber is, but I'm getting tangled up in the wrong part of your question.
That's the extreme case, right?
But you're right, for something in, like, Total War's vastness is like its strength and its weakness, right? And being, I am, just to our earlier point, sort of step back on myself a little bit, I do consider myself a lot of the time to be maximalist as a writer, but mostly in terms of agency. I don't necessarily believe in maximalism in writing a lot in a single go, like paragraphs and paragraphs, but respecting like agency. It's like, oh, the player does this, react to that if you can, if you have the budget and the scope, and that feels like what Total War is in a lot of ways. It's, you do this thing, and you could, like, the more boring version of a Total War campaign is you stomp across the land and you conquer a bunch of cities, and that's it. Game over, complete. It's like, oh, you conquered a bunch of the land, you conquered this city, but this city was actually really important to this religious tribe, and your actions here have set off a chain reaction of events, and there's a rebellion. And that's narrative, that's a story. Your question is whether or not, like, what's the... How do you know whether you've got good bang for your buck in that moment? I don't know if I know that the answer to that question, especially with something as vast as Total War, because my idea would be to make them as more interesting as possible. And then I guess if the litmus test is, regrettably, the litmus test is releasing the game and seeing if seeing if they react to it. Which is like a little zero sum, because if it goes badly, then you've wasted your time. But I mean.
Have you found examples of the games that you've released that have been through that cycle? Have there been examples of storylines that have landed like much better than you expected, or much worse than you expected, or kind of where there's been a gap between how you felt about it and how the audience felt about it?
Yeah, yeah. I got some stuff from Survivor that I don't necessarily need to go too much into, but like I spent spent a lot. I mean, there's a lot of POIs, like point of interest stuff in the overworld, which is our sort of our side content sort of main area. I spent a lot of time on a like a linked quest line, so you could find them in it. The thing about the way that scans work is you find them in any order, so you have to tell stories in a sort of piecemeal way and then put them together at the end like a puzzle. Well, not like a puzzle, just like a line. Go, oh, there's the beginning and there's the end. Spent a lot of time doing like a 10-piece. You find a bunch of data pads, and it's like, oh, this tells you a bit of the story, this tells you a bit of the story, and then it all leads to understanding this character that you meet at the end, and then you convince him to let you in somewhere, and you get something, but then he turns on you. And it's a whole, whole thing. But
his name,
like
his name is Darth. He's a bad guy. Darth isn't his name, obviously. But
it's on his passport. Go on. Sorry,
yes. Showing my ignorance. Carry on, Pete.
Do you want a lightsaber?
yeah, well, you've got a heavy unsubscribes from this podcast. You've got a heavy saber, right? Which is a big one, and then a lightsaber is a light one, obviously.
Yeah, exactly. I have to leave. But I spent quite a long time on this, right? This whole section, working it out, figuring it all out. No reactions. Like, we obviously Reddit isn't like a perfect barometer, but like it's a place that we check to see what people are liking or reviews and stuff. Nothing, right? No real interface with it at all. I wasn't cut up, like I wasn't like my magnum opus, but I spent out quite a long. I think it's like it's a cost benefit analysis, right? It took me too long to have it not really be appreciated. Well, on the flip side, there are things that I've written in like a couple minutes or like an hour that people love. And that's not necessarily world building, although it does sort of contribute to it a bit. It's not really ideal, like I was saying before, that you wait until to the end. But at the same time, I think internally, when I was doing it, people were like, yeah, okay, let's put it in the game. As opposed to, this is great stuff, you really knocked it out of the park with this one. And I think at the time, there's like a gut sense. I was kind of resisting the last 10 minutes and saying, about talking about instinct or gut feelings. But I feel like you can, especially if you've been doing it for a while. You can never fully know whether players will engage and love something or not. But I think developing a sense, like this isn't going to really hit home like I want it to. Fortunately, I've never had a feeling this is an absolute disaster. Because that, I would stop doing it, I think. But I would hope. But yeah, I mean, do you have an example of anything that you guys worked on that's like not what you wanted it to be?
I mean, like so many, but I think one of the interesting things I always find is looking at the ones that work much better than you expect, because one of the things I'm very guilty of when I'm world building myself is I try to understand more than I'm telling the player, so that if they piece things together, they can theorize something which I'm consistent about because I know that it's true, right?
Yeah.
But generally speaking, after doing that for a while, I get a little bit bored and a little bit cantankerous. And so I'll quite deliberately write a contradiction. I'll know that this thing works like this or comes from this place, and I'll deliberately put a contradiction somewhere else just to annoy people who have solved the puzzle of what the thing is. And that's gloriously fun. And most of the time, nobody notices because they're not really piecing it together. They're just sort of going, oh, yeah, this feels like the right shape of world. And I think that talks to the thing that you said in the article about world building reflecting theme. If it feels right, then you don't necessarily need to understand the actual logic of it, if there is one or isn't one. But then every now and then, of course, somebody finds this contradiction and then, even better, explains it, and you go, oh, that's much better than what I had.
Would you say that's even true of something like Heaven's Vault, which is
entirely about...
So you've put lots of little inconsistencies in Heaven's Vault.
Yeah. It's kind of... It's partly a deliberate strategy to make sure that the world is unsolvable, because I feel like that thing of getting the player to ask questions about your world is much more interesting than having the player answer your world. Because then they can stop thinking about it.
Yeah, and it's at over. Least answer in totality. Shut the door.
Yeah,
I think exactly. sorry, I think something I say and then don't say in the article is like about the history of the world remaining forever incomplete. I think like an addendum to that that I didn't put in there is like it's also inconsistent, right? Because of the way history is told to us, right? Like through sources and biases and stuff. So whilst my initial reaction to you saying it's Tree of Heaven's Fault was horror, as a puzzle completionist, I think thinking in reality, especially as a game about archaeology and piecing together history from what you can find, that makes more sense to me. It's inconsistent.
I feel like it would be dishonest to present a world that is complete and rigid because history doesn't work like that. But I kind of want to turn this back on you because I think it leads me to one of my questions, which is if you as a writer want to strategically create ambiguities or gaps or little puzzles or possibly contradictions in your world because it makes the feeling of the game good. So you've got this on one hand, and the players like this, and they engage with this, and they kind of get excited about it. But if you're working with a really big IP, presumably you have a bunch of people on the other hand who want to know precisely what you're saying about their world to an enormous level of detail. Like, just even politically, how do you balance those two things?
I feel like there is, well, I like to hope that there is a middle ground, right? He said very centristly. I think there's a middle ground where you are revealing information, but you don't have to. Like, the level of granularity that you're talking about is that people want to know what type is the engine on that ship and what planet did it come from? What like shipyard made it? And it's like, I'm not going to do that, right? Unless it's I've got a spare hour, right? Like, I haven't, which I don't ever. And then, but on the other hand, there's like, oh, it's this ship, and it was made here. Like, you can give them. I mean, it's funny that you say like there are legions of fans who want to know this information, but also we have stakeholders from the IP that want to know this information too. Yeah. Like, you can't create anything in a vacuum. Like, oh, we designed a new gun. We designed a new ship. It's like we think it's from here, and like, oh, it has to fit this specification. It's like, if that's their job, and I understand that, and I respect it immensely because it keeps us honest. But how much of that filters down into the player sort of thing? I think what we don't, this is me falling back on the crutch again that Cigar mentioned earlier, is like, I don't have to say everything because someone somewhere else might. So if we made a bunch of new ships, I don't need to, ships aren't really a great example of world building here, but like, we made a bunch of new ships and then we put them in and they're cool and stuff. Like, you might actually find them on the official website for the IP, right? You might find it on like StarWars.com. Like, and I haven't got to tell you. And that's like cheating. but
it works. It works. Because if you have that asset, let's say, like, why not lean on it? Like, I've been writing for some of the DLC for Bloodlines 2 and this year, that is, and like Vampire the Masquerade is another of these big complex IPs that has a bunch of internal contradictions already just over the different versions it's had, where you sort of tell or retell some of these stories, and yes, there's a canonical like main version, but it's checkable, as you say, Pete, right? So like, you can like do a bunch of this work kind of on your own, but equally, like, you do need like a positive relationship with the IP holder where you're essentially like saying, hey, we're going to pitch a bunch of things, and you, usually if that's like a productive relationship, you can say, they'll come back and they'll say, like, it might not make sense for this faction to be doing this thing, but you can achieve pretty much the same thing with this other thing. And if they tell that to you before you do character art, great, right?
Yeah. Oh, they're definitely collaborators more than like gatekeepers. I want to be clear about that. But I don't want to be I don't want to put my stamp on something that like feels like I'm never going to change my mind. But to the sort of part of John's question as well is, how do you balance those two? Is that sometimes you have to decide that like the people that want the information don't get the information, right? Like, they really, really want to know the very, very minute specifics because that's the type of IP that you work in. Sometimes you either relegate that to a scan or like something goes in the data bank or goes in the encyclopedia where you can give a more like prose like detailing of things, or you just decide that that's not. It's not worth the time and
it's not
the
relevant
investment.
Or...
Yeah, and perhaps that will upset some people. But it's the same.
But it might be the right decision.
Yeah, it's the same element that's like, my thoughts kind of in my head a little bit. But like, there's a refrain I hear from different elements that I don't necessarily agree with about like, you play to sort of the lowest denominator or like you play to the cheap seats, which I don't necessarily agree with as a like. because it removes the idea of subtlety and nuance, right, and ambiguity, which is the thing that I'm kind of fast like talking about here. So, you know, I respect that they love that stuff, and I'm that kind of Star Wars fan as well, actually, from a very young age. But that doesn't mean that it has to be what drives me through creating that kind of thing. I think it's also like perhaps a misunderstanding of what it means to be in the cheap seat. It doesn't mean that you don't, like, you get the basic information and you might not get what's above you, right, in the gods. But it doesn't mean it has to be stupid or has to be fundamentally sort of like simple words. It doesn't have to be slowly spoken in simple words. I think that's the thing that I think
you're just less familiar with that IP from the start, but that doesn't mean you're not a sophisticated consumer of the media. In fact, like, the reason that even matters is because that's the bigger audience usually, right? It's like there's usually more people in the world who don't know your thing than know it, although maybe Star Wars is an exception to it.
Well, the thing about that is it's not necessarily that they don't know Star Wars, that they don't know video games. A lot of people who play Star Wars video games don't know games, and that's an interesting, because you're speaking in the language of... We write in the language of games a lot of the time. It's like, oh, well, you know, there's a common understanding that, like...
Here's a tech tree, do this thing.
Tech tree. Yeah. Triangle button does jump. Like, you know all these words, and then you bring a bunch of people come in and they don't know what that means. So while you're not necessarily modulating the plot and the writing of, and the exposition, etc., you do sometimes have to modulate the fact that they might not really know what a game is. And that's where you get some of that writing, which isn't world-building, that's a bit more functional, which no writer really likes to write, which is the, oh, I need to go to that mountain over there, you know? Like, and you try and find an elegant way of phrasing that, but sometimes you just need to be like, by the way, this is a video game, and this is how video games work.
My favourite version of that is when you get the line that says, I think I can jump over that box.
Yeah. I'm thinking... You are familiar with my words then, John.
Had your fingerprints all over it, Pete.
This is why I think, like, it, so often in games we really rely on companions or sort of a slightly more knowing fellow ally that can just tell you stuff, because for decades, right, like, games writers have come across this problem and they're like, it would be much nicer if it's like someone on a radio that's telling me what to do than like me to myself, like, announcing this item.
And there's been situations where I've had, like, I mean, I have a beautiful crutch in Star Wars, and I have a funky droid that sits on your shoulder, that sits on Cal's shoulder and follows you around, and you can just vamp at him, and then he goes, oh, boop, beep, beep, right? And you're like, excellent. Yep. Everyone is charmed. It doesn't sound like I'm talking into a void. And then I found a situation in the past where stuff I don't think ended up making it or was somewhere else. I can't even remember. But, like, where I was talking to myself, and I was like, oh, I hate this. Like, I really don't enjoy this at all. Is there a way I can get around this? And regrettably, sometimes there isn't. And I think that's why so many games invent companions, right? Or little droids, or small children, or, you know, people on the radio.
Yeah, some companion. You just went to the student event, Pete. I did one last week as well, and we sort of used a bunch of games as a starting point, and one of them was Stray. So in Stray, you play a cat, not like in a cyberpunk world, but you're just a cat. The world is cyberpunk. You're just a cat. And eventually, necessarily, you acquire a sort of robot companion that can, like, help you talk to the world, right? And, like, interface with it. Because otherwise, you know, your verbs are just limited after a certain point, right? Like, as to what you can do.
Yeah, and Stray's really, really charming. But I often find before you get the robot companion, I think they handle it quite elegantly. But when you talk to people who are robots in the town, their first instinct is like, oh, a cat. What are you looking for? What are you here? And they talk to you. Yeah. I think the nature of the way that you, like, if it was a person, you would talk to it, they would talk to you differently. But it's like, oh, it's a cat. Like, if it was a dog, they'd be like, oh my god, is this a puppy? What are you looking for? But, like, it's infantilizing, but in a way that works.
And that works because that's your player character, right? And then they introduce the companion at just the right time, at just the point at which it would become old or repetitive for you to keep having that. So this is just going to be a perpetual problem, which is like, how do you deliver, like, functional things to the player kind of at the same time when they need it? But it is interesting to see how different game structures have dealt with this distinctly. And it does strike me also that the genre affects this a pretty tremendous amount. Like, it's why I think so many bigger games are like, hey, this is clearly a pirate game. You know a bunch of things. You don't need to be told that, like, in this pirate game, you're going to have a sword at some point, right? Like, like, that's going to be part of what's going on. Or in a horror game, a typical player isn't too worried about you explaining every single answer. They might really want it, but they will understand that you might not, if you give away too much, then the horror goes away, you know, and then they want to stop that. So, yeah, I mean, people get that, I think.
Yeah, and the interesting thing about horror games, I find, not that I play them because I'm a massive coward, but I find one of the cruxes of horror is it's like mystery and horror are very, like, they share a frontier, right? And the more you delve into a horror game or a movie or a book, then you are unraveling the mystery, and you get less scared, I think, unless there's some late staged twist. And this works with some things like you talk about, like Stephen King's like It, right? I'm not scared of that by the end because the kids aren't scared of that by the end, and that's really thematically resonant and really excellent. But it takes like Resident Evil games, which are really enjoyable, but once you reach a certain point, and usually because they go a little bit crazy, the fear sort of fades away. And maybe that's part of the point, but in horror, I find it's almost like you're working against yourself, or you're working against the genre towards the end, because it stops being scary. Unless very crucially, it does not stop being scary, in which case, well done. I just find that really fascinating, sort of like a paradox almost of how you tell a scary story.
I think horror is really, I mean, I'm a massive not horror fan for the same reason as you, Pete, but like it always puzzled me as it being such a popular game genre, because if you look at a horror movie, the construction of it is that it ends on a downer, right? That's the classic horror movie ending, is like the last person survives and then dies anyway. Whereas in a game, players really, I don't know, do they accept that in horror movies? I think players like to survive at the end and win and master the situation. So do we like horror just because, as players, do we like horror because it looks like something we can't beat and then we beat it anyway, so we've done even better than we might have expected? Or are there horror games that end the way I would expect horror games to end, with like, oh yeah, and then everybody dies, and that's the end of the game. Bad luck. you should have died in the first 5 minutes. It would have been easier.
Saved you a lot of time.
Yeah, right, exactly. But I can't really speak to that because I have no idea.
I never used to play any horror games for all the same reasons as the other two of you. But The Chinese Room does a fair bit of horror because it's a quite useful genre to go into the sort of psychological issues that we often cover or these sort of things. But it does do something too, which is it sometimes curtails the game duration so that it feels you don't overstay your welcome, ideally, right? And you can often end on like a really dark revelation, but it would have to be the end, because you would have to have that moment be, that's the last thing the game needs to tell you to sort of complete the circle. And if you keep then having to play afterwards, you get into a similar problem that fantasy games have when they sort of set the antagonist as like a god or like a crazy character, but then they put essentially an HP marker on them where you're like, well, is this the type of thing that if I'm just strong enough, I can beat? Or is this meant to be a sort of cosmic entity that like is not reachable by the likes of me? All of these are choices, right? All of these are design decisions of like what you want the player to feel. Do you want them to feel like they're going through this like big rising journey, or is it more like I'm exploring this world of terrifying dreams and nightmares and things, and then it's different.
Yeah, I find I think a lot of like, I think that's interesting. There's good, like you say, you put a giant cosmic entity like or a god, and then you give them a HP bar. It's like, on one hand, it shatters the illusion that you know, this is some unknowable thing. But on the other hand, you get this very cathartic feeling. It's like, oh, God can be killed. Like, you know, you like, and this, you're like, oh my God, like I can do it, right? I can climb the mountain. The thing I noticed about like hearing, I'm one of those people, I don't watch horror movies or play games because of the cowardice, but I do enjoy reading the Wikipedia pages. So just so that I'm somewhat forearmed, right? And one thing that I notice in what people seem to think are really good horror films, like genuinely scary ones, is the like an 11th hour or literally like in the closing minutes revelation or twist. There's like, oh, you're exploring these catacombs and turns out it's like the belly of a giant beast, and then the movie ends with him getting crushed, you know, and that's right. The end. Or even something that's not quite horror, but something like not even horror, but like a thrill, like Time to Mr. Ripley. The very last minute, it's like, oh, and now I have to kill you as well, and sorry if you haven't seen Time to Mr. Ripley. But you have to like something that really just pulls you right back out, and then you're left feeling with that same like pale horror, that like fear that you had at the in the beginning, like it resets you and then leaves you alone.
Yeah,
I think that's really interesting. I'm still not watching it, but I think that's.
But it comes back to this point, that central emotional feeling that this experience is meant to give you, whether it's a genre you're familiar with, you're watching Scream 7 or something, or whether it's something relatively new to you. It doesn't like purposefully the ingredients are simple enough, or maybe like primal enough that you can sort of get into it quickly, get the point, and then get out when it. when it works, yeah. Which I suppose, like, for some of the heroic journeys that we've talked about here, or some of these big, like, you know, these war stories that we've covered in some of your games, Pete, like, they too have these elements of these, like, central concepts that are understandable across cultures, across time.
I think
to see where someone is going.
To John's question before, point from before about, like, when do you insert contradictions or when do you play with the expectations, like, I think, to speak to a world-building perspective, like I said about horror, is your feels like it's working against itself because you understand the world more as you push through as part of unraveling the mystery and understanding the horror. And then to keep it horrible or horrifying, like you say, the last second you shift the understanding of the world. And I think that's what puts you back into that place. Like, oh, I know this is a haunted house and this happened in this room and, you know, I figured out all of the Cluedo-esque sort of mechanics of it. And then the last second is like, actually, the house is a spaceship or the house is like a cosmic beast, actually. Mm. Clearly I should be a horror writer. And then that sort of under sweeps the whole thing and you're back to being scared again. I think that's how world building, I think, worked with that in the same way as, I mean, it's been 51 minutes and I haven't mentioned Bioshock, but, like, you know, that, like, I mean, the plot twist in Bioshock, which, like, I almost feel like Bioshock would be, not stronger, but, like, would hit a real strong note if you had that revelation that you were, in fact, being controlled the whole time, and then the game ended, right? Like, that's the same sort of thing you get in a horror movie. It's like, oh, I've realized this thing, and now it's done, right? And then you're left with the implication. Yeah. You're also left with, he said, being very segue, you're left with a wall with gaps in it at that moment. You're like, oh, what's going to happen now? What's beyond? Isn't that interesting? Isn't that scary? Isn't that et cetera, et cetera?
Yeah. It reminds me a little bit of the other structure that you see in science fiction films a lot, especially kind of cosmic science fiction films, which I don't think 2001 invented this, but it kind of exemplified by it, where you have a fairly ordinary kind of plot. And then towards the end, because the player is starting, the player or the audience has come to understand the world, they've got it, a lot of their questions have been answered, they see how everything fits together. So the film in the last 10 minutes will just go completely bonkers.
Yeah.
And just absolutely, exactly, because they're just, well, we've done everything we can do here. We can't just go, and then the world carried on with intelligent robots that sometimes kill people. So instead you go, and then there's a cosmic baby, and you know...
Yeah.
The end of Interstellar, which is a really good hard sci-fi movie with the weirdest ending, but somebody must have written and filmed and gone, yeah, that's the one we want. But it's almost like the opposite of the problem that horror has, because you don't want to leave people in the same place. You have to take them somewhere fundamentally different and unexpected every single time, which ends up with this sort of absurd firework at the end of your story.
It's the same narrative structure, though. Yeah. It's like you're going from... It's horror. In horror, you're like, you want to just give them back that feeling, like Pete is saying, of being horrified in whatever way you are. Yeah. And then maybe in the sci-fi, they you want to give them back that sense of wonder, right? Like the classic sci-fi feeling of where can that come from now that you've explained all of the workings?
Now that I've explained everything away, yeah. I guess that's interesting, bringing us back to the subject of kind of world building in these larger IPs that you've worked in. Like, if I'm telling a story in the Star Wars universe, you can't do that, right? You can't go... batch it at the end, like no one's going to let you do that. You can't do that. So is that something that comes up, or is it just fundamentally just a different genre? Actually,
it's like a conversation, I think, all of the time. I think also Star Wars is, I mean, it's prone to batshittery, right? It's there is a degree of it's weird and wonderful, and I think recently there's like a tendency that people to look at it as a structured thing that has a bounding box and only this can exist within it. But not really. I think perhaps we wouldn't... I don't know. I think it's crazier than we give it credit for, but I do think it's
important
to what you're just saying. It's like, you know, a lot of it's understood, you know, which is to say the frontiers aren't defined, but most people will work within what is defined. They sort of make the boundary box out of thin air, you know, and in conversations, there's also like a million things going on in Star Wars that I don't know about at any given time. So it pays to find a comfortable, not comfortable, to find a space that you would like being in and play in that space, you know, and have that little corner to yourself.
Well, having covered this point of what knowledge we have, where things are ambiguous, I think we've circled right back to our beginning. So, Pete, we will end the episode there. Thank you very, very much for spending time with us here. This is I loved getting into the crunchiness of what we've covered here today. please join us next time for when we again rifle through the game narrative kaleidoscope, open up to another article, and have someone new to interview. Much appreciated. I've been Sagar. Thank you.
Thanks for listening, everyone.
Bye-bye.